We have just a little technical difficulty, but welcome to the second discussion series lecture. Last month, we had the opportunity to hear from Professor W. Cole Durham, Jr., who spoke on current developments in international religious freedom. And this presentation is recorded and is now available on our website at iclrs.org. If you go to that website page and scroll towards the bottom of the news blurbs, you'll see a news item on that presentation. If you open that up, you'll see links to either a WMV or a MPEG-4 audio and video file that you can download and hear his comments. We're proud of what he's doing right now. He's just spoken at the Vatican at the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences, a conference that was held in conjunction with the beatification of Pope John Paul II, and he is now en route to Nepal for a conference dealing with the formation of the constitution of that country, and then we'll be going to India, Serbia, Ukraine, Norway, Budapest, and Vietnam, all on this extended trip. So it's an active summer, and we are excited to be a participant in religious freedom worldwide. Yesterday, the center received word of the approval of the Oxford Journal of Law and Religion with Professor Cole Durham as one of the four co-editors-in-chief of this new journal, which we expect will be internationally the leading journal on law and religion. So we're very excited about that new development. You will also be interested to know that the U.S. Supreme Court recently granted certiorari to an important religious freedom case. Hosanna Tabor Evangelical Lutheran Church and School versus EEOC. If you go to our website, there's a news blurb about that case with some links to a lot of additional information. But it will probably be one of the most important religious freedom cases in many years. Our next discussion series lecture will be held on June 23rd, and the presentation will be by Professor Gary Doxey, who was recently called to be in Area 70 of the Church. His presentation is entitled Historical Perspectives on the Rise of Religious Freedom. He has a PhD in history from Cambridge University and has been studying and teaching on the subject of the history of religious freedom. So we encourage you to join us again on June 23rd for that lecture. It is now my privilege to introduce Dr. David Kirkham. He is a senior fellow for comparative law and international policy and a regional advisor for the European Union and the Council of Europe at the International Center for Law and Religion Studies. He joined the firm in 2007 after being the associate dean and a professor at the George C. Marshall European Center for Security Studies in Germany. He began his career as a member of the U.S. Air Force JAG Corps, and I'm reminded of a commercial I saw years ago, join the Army or join the Air Force and see the world. And that has certainly been the situation with Dr. Kirkham. He has lived 15 years of his adult life in five European countries, Germany, Switzerland, the United Kingdom, France, and Belgium. And he officially represented the United States before the United Nations with more than 40 countries and on six continents. He began after the time in the Army, or the Air Force, excuse me, JAG Corps. He was an associate professor of history at the U.S. Air Force Academy. He's conducted international negotiations and diplomatic activities for many years for the U.S. government and for the United Nations, including as a senior humanitarian affairs officer at the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Geneva, Switzerland. His writing and teaching include international human rights, constitutionalism, democratization, revolution, diplomacy, and other global challenges posed by ideological extremism. He lectures and publishes internationally on law and religion topics, and most recently with Professor Durham, Christine Scott, and Rick Torfs. He is an editor of the forthcoming book titled Islam, Europe, and Emerging Legal Issues, to be published by Ashgate Publishers in London. There'll be a follow-up volume later this year or next year. We're very grateful to have Dr. Kirkham with us. He speaks French and German and also holds a PhD from George Washington University. His wife, Judy, is here. We're grateful for that and excited to hear him as he addresses us today on the importance of religious freedom in the context of Islam. Dr. Kirkham.
Well, thank you, Bob. Extended introductions always raise expectations. I'm hoping that this will be worth your time today. For those of you who are listening over the internet, if you brought your lunch with you, I can guarantee some of the next few minutes will be worth your time. Those of you who don't have your lunch, no guarantees. Pleased to be here. I understand the camera's not working. All you're going to see is the PowerPoint slideshow. That's probably good news. Those few of you who are listening over the internet that might be my old law school classmates that were really curious about this and haven't seen me in 30 years, I know you're wondering, dying to know if I'm still handsome and dashing. As long as the camera's not working, I think I can safely say yes. Let me get started by talking to you about some time I spent years ago when I was working on my doctorate, living in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia. I had this habit the last year where I would spend all day in my study essentially conducting research on my dissertation, working on it, trying to put it together, until about 3 o'clock every afternoon. I would take a long hike up a long driveway to meet my little daughter's school bus coming home from kindergarten. So one day I did that. I walk up, and as was my habit in those days, carried a book with me. I was reading the book. Got to the top of the driveway, found out I was a couple of minutes early. The trash can was there waiting to be picked up, so I leaned over the trash can and read my book, and up comes, and actually, I have an actual photograph, the trash truck to pick up the garbage. Young man, probably in his mid-20s, jumps off the truck, looks at me reading my book, and he says, "Ah, the trash toter thinker." He says, "What are you reading?" And I said, "Well, just a book on constitutional history. What do you think of that?" He said, "Well, it's okay if you're a conservative." And then he went on for the next two or three minutes giving me a very, very fine expostulation of his view of the development of constitutional history in the United States. And I was pretty impressed. He jumped back on the garbage truck, drove down the road about 20 yards, slammed on the brakes, stuck his head out the window, and yelled, "These views do not necessarily represent the views of this company." And then he continued on. Well, that anecdote gives me an opportunity to do two things. One is to add my own disclaimer. These views do not necessarily represent the views of the center, of BYU Law School, of BYU, and so forth. But it also, for me, is a reminder of sort of my ideal to live in the kind of a society where people in all walks of life can discuss these kinds of important ideals and ideas of government and law and the things that that culturally operate in our society. About that same period of time, I was reading a book one day by a well-known historian at the time, a man named Clinton Rossiter. The book was called The Political Thought of the American Revolution. And he, in the last few pages of that book, he concludes that although the founders, the revolutionaries of America at that particular time were a diverse lot, which is a good reminder for all of us, they nevertheless, they shared some common ideology, some common ideas. And so he tries to paint what he saw as the common view of the American revolutionary with regard to certain key ideas. And one of the things he says is that in 1776, if one revolutionary were to write out the closest thing to a political consensus, it would have included seeing man as a composite of good and evil. And then he says, quoting Rossiter, if man is a composite of good and evil, then one of the chief ends of the community is to separate his vices from his virtues and help him pursue his better nature. True religion, constitutional government, and sound education are the leading types of collective action that can help him to do this. The first of these encourages man to suppress his savage impulses. The second forces him to think before acting. And the third teaches him the delights of virtue and liberty and the sorrows of vice and slavery. In short, man's saving grace, at least for earthly purposes, is his capacity for learning. Close quote. Well, I'm hoping we'll learn something today together. I think we will in this collective group. Let me talk just a little bit about these three principles. Now, when it says true religion, it might not, I'm hoping that you don't either get too excited or too dismayed about that. I'm talking to a primarily LDS audience. I know that we have a reputation for being quite confident in our convictions, and there's nothing wrong with that, but that's not what this is about. When we're talking about the founders, they're not all adherents to a particular sect or believing that one particular sect needs to be protected and needs to go forth in society, though they were essentially Christian. That's not what it is. It's really the belief that there are true religious principles, that religion plays a key role in society, and so we have to create the kind of environment that will protect that the development and the discussion that goes on that will allow principles of true religion to come forth, to be discovered, to play a part in the community. Constitutional government is what goes so far to create that protective zone. And of course, sound education is how that gets perpetuated from one generation to the next, from one people to the next, as we continue on. Now, why Europe? I'm assuming most of the people that are listening to me right now are American. And so it's a legitimate question to say, why should you take your lunch hour and spend any time talking about, listening to me talk about Europe. I'm giving you three reasons right now. First of all, Europe is one of the places in the world, a key place where you see a Western and an Islamic coexistence, but one with some tension, things that are having to be worked out in key ways. And so it's a training ground for us all. It's a place for us to observe. And you'll notice, by the way, I've put Western in quotation marks. You know that when we get into these kinds of sensitive discussions, especially nowadays where Islam features at the forefront of the discussion, that there are sensitivities here. And one of the sensitivities that is current is using the word Western as contrasting to Islam. And it's not really the best word, because there are a lot of Muslims who were born and raised in Europe, some of them second, third generations, and so on and so forth, who resent the idea that they are from somewhere else. They're Western too. But I thought about it. I couldn't come up for the moment with any kind of a better term to use, so please understand Western. Give me some benefit of the doubt that I am sensitive to the fact that Western isn't maybe the best description, but it's the best that I've got right now, of the kind of traditional Anglo-Saxon, Caucasian, Germanic, Franco, etc., peoples who have lived in Europe for several centuries now. Another reason to look at Europe is because for much of the world right now, Europe is a role model for human rights and democratic values. There are a couple of reasons for that. One, Europe has come into its own. At least since the Second World War, there has been this great, great development that has taken place in European institutions, that fine-tuning of democratic values where they stand strong. There's no question about that. They're also closer to a lot of the countries, both culturally and geographically, that are sort of wrestling with these ideas of democratization and human rights right now. At the end of the Cold War, when you saw other European countries trying to make some kind of a transition to democratic institutions, they were a little bit more inclined to look at Europe than the United States, because Europe was right there on the doorstep. Things were similar enough that they said, oh yes, this works better for us. And another reason is because, like it or not, for those of us who are Americans, there have been things that in our foreign policy in the last 10 years that haven't gone over as well in many parts of the world that have made us a little less popular. And so there are countries out there that are willing to listen maybe to that second witness of Europe to say, okay, we'll look at what Europe has to say. We're not as interested in American models of these kinds of things. I don't want to exaggerate that point, but I can't ignore it either. Final thing is why Europe is very, very important is because of the European Court of Human Rights, which is really, those of you who are here for the seminar, you've heard a lot about this in the last couple of days. You'll hear a lot more in a few minutes. Those who are listening over the internet, I'll talk more about this as the presentation goes on. So here's the tension that we're dealing with. One of the aspects of this tension are Muslims who live in Europe who are feeling like they're just not getting a fair shake. There's a sense that maybe human rights in some people's minds means human rights for Christians or human rights for secularists and so forth, but that when it comes to Muslims, they're not really getting the same kind of appreciation. A lot of countries right now going on in Europe have strong anti-immigration policies that are going to affect the nearly, in Europe itself there are probably, the latest figures I've seen are about 53 million Muslims in the European Union, about 16 million, that's really only about 3% of the population, but it's still, that's a significant number of people, and immigration has continued, and so another reason to look at Europe, most developed countries in the world, are having to wrestle in one way or another with immigration issues. And there have been a number of countries where anti-immigration has been really strong. Meanwhile, and some of those, that, by the way, that are the strongest, you're going to find Netherlands, United Kingdom, France, Austria, Switzerland. All of these have parties that are considered by some to be extreme right, certainly very conservative parties, that have gained considerably in the last few years in their in their power in these particular countries. One of the most recent developments, the French so-called burqa ban. I've written the law here on the slide. The way this is written up in the press, it makes it sound like France just made a law that says no burqas, an anti-Muslim law. Well, the good news and the bad news is that's not what it is exactly. But the law, no one may in a public place wear an article of clothing which obscures the face, period. It doesn't say no Muslim, it doesn't say you can't wear a burqa, it says you can't obscure the face. So if you're a Catholic, if you're a Mormon, if you're an atheist, you can't obscure the face. So that's the sort of the fairness principle. The exceptions to that are things like motorcycle helmets and so forth. But the other side of that is that everyone knows that the reason that they came up with this particular law is because of the burqa, the concern. There are several things that are driving this. Let's look at the... One of the interesting things about the reaction to this law, or to the debate that led up to this law, is that you've got protests going on both sides. You have those on the left of the slide say no to burqas. They were the ones that wanted the ban. You've got those on the right side of the slide, don't tell me what to wear. It's our choice, not yours. So those who are saying no are arguing from two standpoints. One, security. When you can't see somebody's face, you don't know what they're doing, thinking, what they might be hiding under all of this. You can't identify them if they are at the scene of a crime or even a traffic accident and so on and so forth. So they say security is a legitimate concern. There's another group. That's the kind of conservative argument. There's another side. That's the so-called liberal argument to say this is a violation of women's rights, because women are being forced to do this in their homes. There's no way they can get around it because of the requirements of their culture and their religion, and their husbands and neighbors are putting pressure on them to wear these things, and they're never going to be relieved of this if we don't step out with the law and do something. So that's the argument on the don't allow them to wear burqas. And then the argument on the other side is one of this is our religious freedom. This is our, we have the choice to do this, and we should have in a democracy. By the way, here's a picture that shows you burqa and niqab, those that were the dress that was affected by this law. So it's our free choice. It's also our religious duty. These are many of these people who wear these burqas. They're saying, it's not my husband making me do this. I'm doing this for God. And then finally, related to all of that, it's the ultimate modesty. Many of them say, you've put us in this Western society where I'm just not comfortable. Other women may flaunt their bodies and so forth, but that's not the approach I want. So you've got this debate that comes down to an age-old debate between freedom and security. And there are those in the world, just as there have always been, who want to offer absolute security. But freedom pays a great price for that. There are also those who would like to have absolute freedom, in which case security and order goes completely out of society. So there's no easy answer to this. There are other countries now looking at the banning of the burqa and the niqab. Here's one European approach. Politics, we have to hope that women who cover their faces see the light and unveil, but they shouldn't be forced by law to do so. Now, I'm sure whoever came up with this is well-intended, and it seems like a nice compromise. It's still a little condescending, I think, to practicing Muslims. I think I would certainly read it as so. But at least it captures both sides here. Now, there have been a number of events in Europe over the last few years that have really created this tension between the Islamic community and Europe. Theo van Gogh, many of you remember him, controversial Dutch filmmaker. He was controversial among the Dutch, but then he became very controversial among Muslims when he created a film called Submission. He did this with Ayn Hirsi Ali. Many of you probably know who she is. Wrote a famous book, Infidel, who had fled Somalia, ultimately became a member of the Netherlands Parliament, now lives, I think, in exile in the United States. But they created this film that showed how Muslims treated women badly. And certain radical elements of the Muslim community didn't like that. And so on a day in 2004, when Theo van Gogh was riding his bicycle to work, he was shot 8 times by this man in the bottom right corner, Mohamed Bouyeri. And then he was stabbed twice, as if shooting someone 8 times wasn't enough. And as part of the stabbing, he left a note on Van Gogh's body threatening Jews and Western countries and Ali and Ayaan Hirsi Ali. He's serving a life in prison without parole, but the note also left a lot of ideological anti-European in the name of Islam ramblings, and he was tied to a little terrorist group that was also later broken up. Several acts of terrorism have been committed by so-called Muslim extremists. I think this is a place where I should once again put out this caveat on the words we use. I've been at a lot of conferences in many parts of the world attending with a lot of good Muslims, and when this comes up, they say, don't call them Muslim extremists, don't call them Islamic terrorists. If they're terrorists, if they're extreme, if they're violent, has nothing to do with Islam. Get that word out of there. And in a way, I'm very sympathetic with them, but I say, then how are we going to discuss this? Because they call themselves Muslim. They say that they take their inspiration from the Quran and from the Prophet Muhammad. So how can we really discuss and understand this if we just throw it out? And they don't want to do it. Sometimes I will remind them that I'm a Mormon, and I'll say, you know, there are these little splinter groups among the Latter-day Saint communities in the West that I'm not particularly fond of what they do, and I don't like it when they call themselves Mormons because they do things that I don't approve of. And yet, they use the Book of Mormon, they call themselves Mormons, and we share a common heritage at some point. Maybe it was over 100 years ago that we stopped sharing that common heritage, but at some point, to understand them, you have to go back and understand them as Mormons. And so don't make us not say Muslim. So, but again, don't think at all when I talk about Muslim extremists that I'm suggesting that Islam is itself a violent religion, or that all Muslims have some kind of tendency towards extremism. It's not true at all. The vast, vast majority of millions and millions of Muslims on the earth, I am convinced, are good people who want good things. So anyway, you know about the terrorist bombings that took place in Spain and London and some other places. Danish cartoons crisis, 12 cartoons that were published in 2005, protests across the world, Danish embassies were overrun in Syria, Lebanon, and Iran. About 100 people died in the riots and so forth. Again, this really pitted East against West, or Islam against West, in this sense of Europeans are saying, wait a minute, one of the most fundamental principles is freedom of expression. And that might mean even drawing some cartoons of Muhammad that kind of poke fun a little bit at things that we find that aren't terribly rational. Whereas you've got on the other side people saying, you don't understand. Our religion is the most sacred thing, the most important thing in our lives. And for you to mock it, it's anathema. It is contrary to what God wants, and it's so offensive to us that we can't just sit back and let you do that. Now, I won't spend a lot of time talking about the anti-defamation movement that's been kind of moving and rising in the last few years. There's been every year in the last probably 10 years, there's been a push in the United Nations to try and get a resolution adopted that calls for or makes into essentially international law a principle that says you can't defame another person's religion. Now, again, as a Latter-day Saint, there's something that feels kind of good about that. You think, open up the Salt Lake Tribune, and Jimmer Fredette just scored from the free throw line against Utah, and that gives all the bloggers an opportunity to say how evil the Mormons are, you know? And you get tired of that. So you can see why somebody doesn't want their religion defamed, but the price you pay for that from a Western point of view, from my point of view, is just way, way too much. Rather let them talk, or rather let them say what they want to say, but keep that marketplace free so that I can get up and say the opposite and say you're wrong. So, another controversy has been Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, in 2008. He's the head of the Anglican Church, essentially. You've got a situation in Britain, in many countries now, where the Islamic community within the country has pushed for the adoption of certain elements of Sharia law. And in some countries that's happened. You have in the UK, for example, you'll have some arbitration groups that will deal with family issues that follow the principles of Sharia law. You had in 2004 the Islamic Bank of England, who was the first bank in Europe to adopt Islamic principles with regard to interest rates and loans and so forth and so on. So when the Archbishop of Canterbury made these observations, and he said, among other things, the quote I have here, "It seems unavoidable, and as a matter of fact, certain conditions of Sharia are already recognized in our society." What's unavoidable? It's unavoidable that we accommodate some of the Muslims living within our society so as to let them feel like they've got full citizenship and all of the rights of citizenship. Well, that really created a storm. Really created a storm and made people say, Sharia law, is the Archbishop of Canterbury saying that we should allow these people to cut off the hands of thieves and, you know, stone adulterers and so on and so forth, which was extremely taken out of context and misconstrued, both from what Muslims really believe and from what he said. He added this explanation later. "Our general position is that Sharia law cannot be used as a justification for committing breaches of English law, nor should the principles of Sharia law be included in a civil court for resolving contractual disputes." But that was, you know, it wasn't enough to entirely quell the controversy. One of the more recent ones has been the Swiss minaret ban of November 2009. This has been debated in Switzerland for at least since 2000. But in 2009, they held a referendum in Switzerland, 26 cantons. Four of them voted, no, we shouldn't ban minarets. The other 22 voted, we should. It was 57.5% of the population that said, no more construction of minarets in Switzerland. There are four existing in Switzerland now. But they said no more. The government came out against it. The government said that's a violation of international humanitarian rights, but so far the government has not prevailed over the referendum given the nature of the Swiss government. So let's talk about the European Court of Human Rights. What's its role in all of this, and how has it been doing in terms of defending the rights of Muslims, but at the same time balancing those rights with legitimate concerns of the rest of the society? Here are a few things about the European Court of Human Rights. We probably hear this in the news all the time. Sometimes we won't pay attention to it. If you're a lawyer, you may pay a little bit more attention to it, but there are many, many people who really don't quite understand how it fits in. They tie it to the European Union. It's not. It's not part of the European Union. European Court of Human Rights is a function of the Council of Europe, which was created in 1949 to further democratic and human rights values and cultural European cultural values. And there are 47 members of the European Court of Human Rights, unlike the EU, which only has 27 members. So the Council of Europe includes basically almost every member of the former Soviet Union except for Central Asian countries. It includes a lot of countries that will never be members of the European Union. It serves 800 million citizens. So that alone is a reason to pay some attention to this court. There are a lot of people that are going to be bound by its decisions. I call it quasi-enforceable. I don't know if a judge of the European Court were to be here today, if he would like me saying it's quasi-enforceable, because in theory it's enforceable. In reality, I say quasi-enforceable. Here's the way it works. A country is taken to the European Court of Human Rights. It's the defendant, what we would call a defendant, is always a nation. It's always a country. Because what happens is the applicant, the petitioner, the plaintiff, so to speak, is someone who has gone through that, who has alleged a violation of their human rights, a person or a body, has gone through the entire system of the courts in their own country and still not found satisfaction. And so when they go to the European Court of Human Rights, they're saying, this country, Switzerland, or this country, Russia, or Turkey, or Germany, or France, did not uphold my human rights, and so I am taking the country to court. And so, in theory, when the decision is found against the country, if it's found against the country, that country then is responsible to see that it's enforced. Now, some countries are much better at enforcing these than others. There's a book written that tracks how well these have all, the decisions have been executed, the remedies have actually been followed through, and it's a pretty good record, though some countries are pretty slow. Why there's not a police mechanism to go in and force these countries to do it, really the best they have, the ultimate sanction would be you can no longer be a member of the Council of Europe if a country refused to enforce all of the decisions. And that makes that country a pariah nation. It gives them a terrible reputation in this day and age where certainly democracy is the watchword in all of these countries. And it would probably lead to other sanctions. There would probably be implications for trade with the country and so on and so forth. So no country wants to be kicked out of the Council of Europe. No country has been kicked out of the Council of Europe. But that's the ultimate sanction. And yet, if a country really just chose not to go along with it, then that's why I say quasi-enforceable. I've already mentioned it rules on individual or state applications of alleged violations of civil and political rights. Individuals can apply directly, unlike so many international tribunals. It's not just state against state. Individuals can actually go to the court after they've exhausted their remedies. And then, since 1998, it's been a full-time court. It's located in Strasbourg, France. I'm not going to talk about all of these things, but you can look at the slide, and you can see in just a real quick nutshell, these are the principles that the court upholds. They all come from the European Convention on Human Rights, which, again, is one of the most important human rights documents in the world today because, A, it seems to have captured in that post-World War II period all of those things that were coming out of the war where it was quite clear to everyone that the world had gone wrong, international community had gone wrong. So when we saw Holocaust, when we saw aggressive wars, when we saw mass violations of human rights, this document captured it, but with the added benefit that there's a court that actually enforces it, unlike, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, for example, or something like that. Let's look at just a couple of key cases on European Court of Human Rights that have affected Muslims. Professor Javier Martinez-Torron, who is on our advisory council here at the International Center for Law and Religion Studies, he's a Spanish professor of law, and he has written a really nice opening chapter to the book that Bob mentioned that we've just finished writing and editing. And he goes through, and his article is, how have Muslims fared really overall in Europe in terms of the court protecting their rights? And he finds that in most cases, especially the early cases of the court, Muslims did really well. The court found, for example, that Greece could not declare for the Muslim community who their mufti was to be. Declared that a law in Bulgaria that exempted Christian and Jewish children from religious training in public schools, but didn't exempt Muslims, who were not of the maybe Orthodox Islam, was in violation of those Muslims' rights. In cases of blasphemy, the court were upheld in a number of cases the applicants' rights were violated when they were arrested for blasphemy and said that they were to be allowed free speech when these were Muslims expressing those views. In another case, the court refused to hear a petition from an extreme rightist who had been arrested for anti-Islamic activities, essentially putting up signs in his window and so forth that said, get Muslims out of Europe. And they refused to hear his appeal. They allowed his arrest to stand. And then hate speech, supposed hate speech by Muslim applicants was overturned in a number of cases. So up to a certain point, it seems like Islam has been treated very well before the court, but there have been a couple of key cases where it's more questionable. One of the most famous is Leyla Shaheen versus Turkey. This is known as the headscarf case. The headscarf is a symbol of great divide between Islam, the secularism of the West, and Islamic religious values. Leyla Shaheen was a medical student who had been studying for almost 5 years medicine in a Turkish university, and then she moves to Istanbul and transfers to the Istanbul University for her 5th year, and she wears a headscarf to class. Here's what she's wearing, the hijab. Unlike the niqab, unlike the burqa that I showed you earlier, that really does obscure what people look like and so forth, this is essentially a modest scarf worn over the head that leaves the face entirely uncovered. And so she wears this scarf to school, the University of Istanbul Medicine, School of Medicine, and they tell her that she's not permitted to come to class as long as she wears it. She insists. They refuse to allow her to stand for the final exams. They suspend her from school for a semester. She takes the cases up through the Turkish courts, and the Turkish courts find against her because they say this is in violation of the strong constitutional principle of secularism that has existed in Turkey since our republic was founded in the 1920s under Ataturk, where we insisted on this so that Islamic or religious extremism of any kind would not ever be able to take hold in the country. So they refused to allow her to wear this. She fights it through the courts for a year and a half. She ultimately goes to the University of Vienna to finish her studies. And then eventually this comes before the European Court of Human Rights. By the time it gets to the European Court of Human Rights, things have changed in Turkey. The biggest change has been that the government is no longer unfriendly towards Islam. It's a pro-Islamic government. And so they no longer want to win the case. It's a real irony. So they don't go on and put on their best defense of the case. Meanwhile, Leyla Shaheen's lawyer, who you know is not necessarily the world's expert on religious freedom law, he goes and he makes his case, but he loses. The court finds on behalf of the Turkish government, but because the Turkish government didn't really give great arguments and so on and so forth, there's this irony is that it didn't make good law, but it set difficult precedent. It set the interesting, most ironic thing about it all is that of all the nations members of the Council of Europe, Turkey is probably the most Islamic, and yet Turkey is the only country that bans wearing the headscarf at the university. So it's left this really uncomfortable situation, and there have been at least 2 cases followed up afterwards that the court didn't even hear because they were similar cases. So what's Europe going to do in this particular case? The next interesting one for me, and these are the two women we emphasize the most in this book, is the Refa Partizi case. That's the against Turkey again. Refa Partizi is a political party. It's the welfare party of Turkey. It is a pro-Islam party that if you look in its founding documents and its ideology and its its political positions over the years, you'll see that it's very pro-Islam, wants to get rid of secularization in Turkey, and some documents even go so far as to say, if we need to wage jihad, a holy war, to do this, we will do this. And so Turkey comes out and says, we can't have that kind of party in this country. They ban the party, even though at the time of the banning, it was the largest political party in Turkey, and it had been part of a ruling coalition for 3 years. So this isn't just some little tiny obscure party hiding out, having meetings in some dark alley in Ankara or something. This is a major, major political party. They go before the European Court, the Refa Partizi does, eventually, after exhausting their remedies in Turkey and to no avail. And the European court finds, tries to do a kind of a balancing act, but it finds in for Turkey, and basically says, we have this wide margin of appreciation. This is one of the main principles that the court follows, that basically says we need to, there's a lot of different countries, a lot of different cultures that are part of this Council of Europe, and we need to sort of give the benefit of the doubt to the country with their laws and so forth. So they said Turkey was not outside of its margin of appreciation in choosing to ban this political party. Now, this is a pretty tough thing for us to have to come to grips with. I told this group that's in front of me today, the students who are here, about a situation when I was teaching a group in Senegal a few years ago. They were government officials and so forth, and we were talking about some of the stabilities, some of the staples of democratic society, and we were talking about coup d'etat, and a general from an African country stood up and he said, what do you do when you freely elect your president according to democratic processes, and at the end of the 4 years, your president says, I refuse to go. I'm not going to leave. I'm going to stay on as president. And this was a couple of months before President Clinton was due to move on and give way to President Bush, and I just had this imagined in my mind, President Clinton standing before the American people and saying, sorry, I've decided to stay. And for an American, it's totally absurd. And yet, in Ghana, where he was, it was a reality that they had recently experienced. So, can you imagine the United States Supreme Court, for example, trying to outlaw one of our main parties? It's pretty tough to imagine they do that with Democrats or Republicans, but my wife and I were jogging together this morning. She said, what if the Tea Party broke off? What if the GOP split? And they decided to outlaw the Tea Party. Scandalous. We would never stand for it. And yet, this is what happened in Turkey. One of the main parties in the country was banned. Well, these are tough issues. How should we approach it? I'm going to wrap up here fairly quickly, I think, I hope. One of the things we do here at the center is we monitor these cases. We are a key player in what's known as the Strasbourg Consortium at the European Court of Human Rights. We've essentially helped create this consortium, maybe even did create it, but certainly we're not alone in it anymore at all. We have a number of European institutions and European scholars and lawyers who are part of this consortium, and we monitor the cases and have tried to create a climate where there will be more discussion within Europe about the freedom of religion and belief cases. Where we have tried to create a climate that will allow for more and encourage more interventions at the European Court of Human Rights by other organizations. They don't have the tradition that we have of the amicus briefs, though there is within the European Convention, there is allowance for interventions by third parties. And so we've been already involved to some extent with some of those interventions that have occurred and trying to encourage friends and so forth in Europe to do the same kind of thing. We have, by the way, I kind of had to make a quick picture of this, didn't really get to capture the website, but the website is essentially, it's strasbourgconsortium.org. That's just, as one word, Strasbourg Consortium. I know we could have made it simpler, something that everyone could spell, but that's what it is. And we send out a regular newsletter, an irregular newsletter, I guess I should say, right, Don Lu? But we do try to send out a newsletter about once a month that updates the latest on what's going on in Europe with regard to freedom of religion, conscience, and human and belief. And those of you who are listening, if any of you are interested in receiving this newsletter, then go ahead and send an email, which is simply to newsletter@strasbourgconsortium.org. And again, I should have put it up on the slide. Sorry that I didn't. But again, newsletter@strasbourgconsortium.org. We'd love to have you on that mailing list. So we work with people throughout Europe, we're writing the books, we're doing these kinds of things to try and move it forward. But you can see there are no easy solutions to this. There is not a party line that just covers it at all, covers all the answers. The tensions between the so-called West, the secular societies in Europe, secular society to the extent that that's what we're living in America, and people with strong religious values, particularly now in the case of Islam, those are real. And you can't, if you're standing where we are, both promoting religious freedom and at the same time promoting human rights and democratic values in general, you can't just go away and take one side or the other. How do we do this? Well, many of you are familiar with Bill Atkin, who is the International Legal Counsel for the LDS Church. Something he says to us from time to time, which I think is a great reminder, he's quoting someone much better known than Bill Atkin, is that when we approach these things, we need to be as wise as serpents and as harmless as doves. It's hard work to do that because you have to look at every individual situation. And so if you're an American and you have to weigh the desirability of free speech versus religious freedom, and then you have a man who seems to be a little bit, you know, of a crackpot, who's a pastor in Florida who decides to publicly burn the Quran, where do you come down? Or if they want to build a mosque, or it's not even a mosque, an Islamic community not that far from ground zero, where do you come down on these things? You have to really make sure that you consider, yes, security implications, but certainly the fundamental rights for all peoples, including, and maybe I'll maybe even say especially Muslims, because theirs are in some ways so much under threat right now. Looking at them all as children of God and so forth, I was trying to think of the words that I would like to use to characterize where I would like to be on this, what I would like to be, and I thought of, and I chose these words carefully, and I'd like to be an effective advocate and an exemplar of moral liberty and relief of the oppressed. Now, that sounds really high and mighty, but this is somehow trying to carve out an ideal, and I didn't say I want to be some kind of revolutionary or activist, but an advocate, but an effective advocate. Somebody who actually gets some results. This is kind of where I think we ought to be going. But remember, these words do not necessarily represent the views of this company. And an exemplar of moral liberty, not just liberty, because liberty is so much that's not good gets done nowadays in the name of liberty. But then once you qualify it and you say moral liberty, then somebody said, oh, well, that just opened it up for you to put any curtailment on liberties that you want. And that's also something of concern. Again, this is not about a particular religion. This is about creating that marketplace free and open so that religion can grow and thrive, and those who are convinced that their religion is true have a fair shot at sharing those ideas and ideals. Let me end with this quote from Edmund Burke. I guess this sort of puts the moral liberty emphasis. Society cannot exist unless a controlling power upon will and appetite be placed somewhere. And the less of it there is within, the more there must be without. In other words, if people aren't restraining themselves, then government by necessity to maintain some kind of order has to then put the restraints. Burke says, it is ordained in the eternal constitution of things that men of intemperate minds cannot be free. Their passions forge their fetters. Thank you very much, and I don't know if we have time for questions, but some of you have finished your lunch, I'm sure, and have gone on to bigger and better things, but Bob, if you know how to work it technologically, let me know if they're...
They can simply type in questions as part of their GoToWebinar service. Get that, or we can have questions in the room.
Are you hearing that? They say you can type in questions as part of your GoToWebinar service. Meanwhile, those of you in this room, if you have questions, while others are typing, please. Josh?
With regards to the the European court. How are judges placed on the court? What are the like? What are the requirements? Are there rotating?
Yes, that's a good question. I may miss a little of this in the detail, but I certainly won't miss it in the principle and the general idea. There is a judge representing every single country. They serve for 6-year terms, and then they're elected by the country or designated by the country. And then there is an option or an opportunity for they can be reelected. So every country is going to have a judge. It's one of the it's one of both the strengths and one of the challenges of the court. It's because when you have 47 different countries represented, they're not all on the court is broken up into. There are some initial panels, there are chambers, and then there's the grand chamber. So the grand chamber has 17 judges at any time. And the chambers, what I'm trying to remember, Don Lu, is at 3 in the chamber courts. And so they'll be serving in different courts. They won't all be on that grand chamber, which is like the ultimate Supreme Court. But they will all be represented. And so it's difficult to be able to find law that is going to sort of be just and at the same time be acceptable in each of those cultures that are represented.
So can a judge from a certain country where a case is coming from, are those judges able to still hear that case, or
yes.
do they need to recuse
yes.
themselves?
They wouldn't recuse themselves just because it's from their country. They may recuse themselves if they had, just like any judge, have any kind of particular involvement with the case, but not just because it's from their country. So, other questions? Yes?
So we talked about Turkey, and we've heard about France a lot, maybe as examples of countries that have had some pretty high-profile cases where discrimination against Islam was maybe taking place. Are there, and if so, which countries are sort of leading the way, did you say, as far as...
Yeah, that's a good question. In general, you'll find countries like Scandinavian countries that have done real well. Obviously, countries where the majority is Muslim do well, too. Albania and so forth. But Scandinavian countries, I'd say, in general, have done well. There's no country without controversy. The Netherlands really, really...